Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
The New Statesman.
Hi, I'm Anoush, and on today's episode of the New Statesman podcast, we're looking into the state of the NHS, strikes, and how they're impacting the governments and opposition parties of Scotland and Wales. So let's begin in Scotland. I'm really pleased to be joined down the line by Chris Dearan, our Scotland editor, who we haven't had on the pod for a while, sadly, because he's been unwell. And so I'm particularly pleased to have him on today. And I do encourage our listeners to read his very striking piece about his experience in hospital on the New Statesman. The headline, "My Life Flashed Before Me. Hang on, where were the good bits?" Chris, I would have hoped featuring on the New Statesman podcast would have been one of the good bits.
I don't know what to say, Anoush. My life was flashing before me. Being on the New Statesman podcast didn't really seem to rate a mention.
At least it wasn't one of the bad bits.
That's true.
I'm really glad to have you back, and I'm glad to hear that you've recovered. So thanks for joining us. And actually, maybe we should start with the state of the health service in Scotland. We're speaking on Thursday afternoon. This episode will come out in a few days' time on Monday. But at the time of recording, Scottish A&E units have just had their worst weekly figures ever, with almost 2,000 people waiting over 12 hours to be seen and less than 50% being seen within the four-hour target time. You've written in your latest piece about this on the New Statesman website that Scots are watching their NHS blow up like the Hindenburg. So can you give us a bit of a picture of what's going wrong there and what it's like?
It's probably easier to say what's not going wrong, to be honest. And I know that this is not particular to Scotland, and the things are going wrong in Wales and England, and I'm sure Northern Ireland as well. Mm-hmm. But I think in Scotland, one gets the impression very often that the NHS up here is seen and is certainly talked about by our political leaders as being somehow superior to what's going on elsewhere in the UK, that they'll put more funding in, that the relationship between the government and the NHS workforce is better, et cetera, et cetera. But the reality is that the NHS is a mess and has been for a long time in Scotland. And we've got to the stage now where I think you struggle to find anyone working in any aspect of healthcare who would have very positive things to say about the state of things. I was in hospital just as we talked about being ill for a bit. And I was actually in Forth Valley Hospital, which has the worst A&E waiting times in the country by a long way. And it was absolutely fascinating seeing it from the inside, because it's not something, God willing, many of us have to look at. But the strain that was on the staff, especially the nurses and the doctors, the consultants, just the sheer volume of work they were having to get through. They were understaffed because people had left during COVID, or people were working for moving into the private nursing bank. The volume of people coming in was huge, putting patients into cupboards, using them as mini wards. The wards themselves were packed full of more beds than they should have had. And it just felt chaotic, I think, the whole time I was in there, despite the extraordinary efforts of the people that were working there. And people were waiting for hours down in the A&E waiting room. That was before we got really into the proper winter breakdown that we're seeing now. It was as bad as that then. I'm very glad I'm not in hospital at the moment. And I suppose that what we've seen with strikes and whatever around the UK, the Scottish government has tried to get around the table, and that's been talked about a lot at Westminster, I know, in contrast to the Conservative government at Westminster. And they've had a bit of success with some NHS staff, but there are still, I think, plans for nurses to walk out and rejected a deal that was offered by the Scottish government. Things have got to a pretty sorry state, as we know, when nurses are walking out, and inevitably that's going to make things worse rather than better. And I guess what we have is the almost perfect storm of the aftermath of COVID, and people still having COVID, but we've got all the consequences of cancelled operations, etc. We've got flu which is what running through the population at the moment. Strep has been talked about, bed blockers and all the kind of stuff that we're seeing. And it certainly feels like the NHS up here is almost beyond creaking now and is starting to fall apart. The people I know that work in the health service are just absolutely at their wits' end, and they don't particularly feel that the government in Scotland is riding to their rescue anytime soon.
That's really interesting, because you did make that point that Nicola Sturgeon speaks about her relationship with the Scottish NHS as if it's superior to the NHS in the rest of the country. And like you say, they did have some success in staving off strikes at the end of last year when you saw NHS staff striking across the rest of the country. And they've also decided to raise taxes on higher earners as well to put into the health service. So they are doing some things differently. To me, that feels like it could be just as much of a risk as a sort of opportunity to make it look like Scotland goes it alone or Scotland's some kind of pioneer, because that means it dampens some of the argument of we'll just blame Westminster for the issues in our public services, which you write about in very strong terms in your latest piece. I think you say that how it's not our fault is the one phrase that sums up 15 years of SNP rule.
The SNP are always very happy to point out where aspects of the Scottish NHS and some of the data that comes out, if it's even marginally better than what we've seen in the rest of the UK, is pointed out that, hey, we're much better at the NHS in Scotland than we are in the UK. Whereas now Hamza Yousaf, our hapless health secretary, is very quick to say that it's just as bad in England as it is up here, because things aren't going particularly well. I think the problem with the buyout, they've put taxes up a little bit on better off, and they're using that to put some money into the health service. But the reality is that injection isn't going to make much of a difference. We know that the NHS eats money. And if you go back to the New Labour years and the massive injection of money that went into it then, which made some difference, but it was on such a very different scale to what we're talking now. And also it was accompanied by quite a large programme of reform as well. Remember the diagnostic and treatment centres that Blair brought in, which were privately owned. The government basically paid them to bring waiting lists down with some success. Yeah. The ideology is such up here that the idea of using the private sector to reduce waiting lists is anathema. And that I think the pro-independence movement, as well as the SNP as the leading pro-independence party, have set their stall out in such that the idea of the private sector being involved in anything to do with the NHS is anathema, despite the fact, of course, that GPs are already private and there are other aspects of the NHS that are already private, but we're not allowed to talk about that. I think the problem is that you can put as much money in really as you want, but if it's not accompanied by reform and modernisation, then it's not going to make a huge amount of difference. And we actually saw, I think, during COVID, because of the sort of scale of the problem that went on then, there was quite a lot of modernisation went on within the NHS. I can only talk about up here. I'm sure it was the case throughout. But a lot of the things that the NHS has been dragging its feet on in terms of computerisation, digitalisation, that sort of thing, in the course of the crisis, they were forced to take some steps forward on that stuff. And it made quite a difference. But unfortunately, now it seems like we're running into the usual sands, which is that the SNP simply needs more money, but there is no amount of money you can throw at it that is actually going to make a huge difference to the outcome. So I suppose in the piece I've written for this week, one aspect of what I'm looking at is simply that if you have been in government for 15 years like the SNP have, and you've tried very hard not to annoy nurses or doctors or the health unions by proposing reforms, which might be difficult for some of these people, you might be asking them to give up some deeply ingrained practices, you might be asking them to modernise some of the working practices that they have, and it might not be easy for those people or comfortable. If you've spent 15 years not doing that and allowing things really to get tougher for patients, tougher for doctors, events happen like COVID that make things much, much harder as well, then when it comes to the point where you really do hit the crisis, you haven't done the hard work in advance that might allow you to get through it that bit more easily. And instead, what you end up with is the SNP just saying, we're putting more money in than down south because we care a bit more. And the truth is, it's not going to make a bit of difference. And Nicola Sturgeon feel a bit better about herself, but it's not going to make a huge amount of difference to many patients in Scotland.
And when it becomes clear that it won't be making that much difference, which I agree with you, it seems unlikely that an injection of a bit of extra cash is really going to dampen down this crisis in any significant way. Will it not then beg the question of who is to blame them? Will they go back to blaming Westminster for not giving them enough money to put into the health service, or austerity on a national level?
Yes, is the answer, because that's what they always do. And perhaps they have an argument that obviously through the years of austerity, the money that could have been spent wasn't. But it's not just about money. And I think we're seeing that in public services, certainly in Scotland, where there has been more spent on the public services per head of population than we've seen elsewhere in the UK. And the results, it's not just in health, it's also in education, are no better and often worse than we see elsewhere in the UK. And that's because a lot of that spending is not accompanied by any real reform. It's a very soft approach to the public services. And if you think that perhaps the role of government is to do the hard yards on reforming public services, they're never finished public services. They constantly need modernised and updated. And I think if you look at some of the highest performing services around the world, actually, some of the states that the SNP would aspire to, there have been hard conversations between governments and, say, public sector workers and a lot of changes to working practices to ensure that those public services are as modern and as user-friendly as they might be. And we simply haven't had that conversation in Scotland at any point since devolution started. Possibly the Labour government, Labour Lib Dem government in the early years moved a bit on that. But 15 years of SNP government, we've seen very little appetite for reform, very little attempt to modernise public services. And as the data comes out, the data that they will let us see, because they've obviously done their best to sit on a lot of data or just prevent it coming out in the first place, it shows us that things are declining. And the problem we have is that in Scotland, voters are pretty much 90% of voters vote in elections based on their constitutional preference. It's nothing to do with the performance in schools or the performance of the NHS. It's to do with, do you want independence or do you not want independence? And therefore, it really suits the SNP to blame Westminster for everything and to say, if we were independent, we can offer you this better funded public services, higher public sector salaries. Nonsense. But they're able to throw that out there. And because voters are really thinking about elections in terms of the constitution, they'll be swayed one way or the other, depending on what the constitutional preference is. So what that means is we're not having a debate about education reform, or we're not having a debate about health reform. And those services grind on. There's no oil in the gears left anymore, but they grind on, and a bit more money's thrown here, a bit more money's thrown there. Westminster is blamed for there not being more money, but the system is not working as it should. And that's where real political leadership and real courage to reform public services, and sometimes to go against the vested interests and the people that are working in those public services, because as ever, people don't necessarily want to change their working practices. Sometimes it has to be forced on them. But we haven't done that in Scotland. There's been some of that in the rest of the UK, certainly in England during the Blair and Cameron years. It's happened elsewhere in the world as well. But in the end, I think you get public services you get depend on the government you elect. And if you keep electing a government that has no interest in reforming because its interest is in Scotland becoming independent, then you'll get the public services that you voted for.
Yes.
That's a bit gloomy, I know.
You make that point in your piece. It's quite a sad ending.
Things are not good. And there's no point in, I think, regardless of who you vote for, looking at the state of public services at the moment and saying, hey, haven't the SNP done a great job and haven't the Tories done a bad job? They've both done a bad job. And we can see all around us that the world is changing and that, you know, there's a lot of digitalisation coming into public services, that there's a lot of need to change the way we think about public services, how we fund them, a lot of new demands coming online. And we haven't faced up to any of that yet. And I think until we do, we're just going to be like Groundhog Day. Every winter we'll have this a bit worse.
Yeah, it's really interesting because you mentioned public opinion there and what drives people to vote in elections. It's quite different in England. Keir Starmer seems quite confident against Rishi Sunak. Conservatives are trailing in the polls. We saw both of them do these New Year speeches and you could see the contrast between the two of them. It feels a little bit like we're headed towards a change in government, although anything could happen. How has the situation in the NHS and the wider sort of malaise in public services that you've just described affected public opinion of Nicola Sturgeon and the SNP? And are the opposition parties in Scotland landing any blows particularly successfully?
Most recent polls, I think, have shown that public confidence in the SNP to run, say, the NHS has dropped quite a bit. But that, right, as I was talking about people basing their vote in the constitution, that doesn't mean support for the SNP has dropped quite a bit, or indeed support for Nicola Sturgeon herself. The last, I think, 5 or 6 polls have shown that support for independence has been above 50% when you remove the don't knows from the equation, which is, I think, the longest run of an advantage for independence that we've seen. And pollsters I've spoken to would put a bit of that down to the Supreme Court ruling that the Scottish Parliament wasn't entitled to hold an independence referendum under its own steam. I think there's a bunch of voters who don't like the idea that Holyrood can be told what it can and can't do by Westminster. There's also, I think, finally, the sense that Brexit is proving to be a block on economic growth and on maybe identity, Scottish identity being what it would prefer to be, starting to feed through into those figures as well. And as we see the impact that Brexit's having on economic growth and on businesses and communities that people are in Scotland, who obviously voted by a substantial majority to stay in the European Union, are starting to, there's quite a close alignment now between people who voted Remain and people who are moving over to Yes on the constitutional picture. So I think those are probably the two things that are driving that push for independence at the moment. That said, the pollsters I've spoken to don't think it's probably a long-term shift, that things will probably balance back out towards 50-50 where they've been for a long time. The SNP seem impervious to any mistakes and all criticism. They're still miles ahead. The opposition parties are still battling it out for second place somewhere in the SNP's rearview mirror. And I guess until that link between constitutional preference and your vote in an election is broken, we're pretty much going to stay that way. And it will really be SNP in power and then Labour versus Conservatives to be the opposition.
Right. Okay. Because it's interesting what you say about the potential impact of that Supreme Court decision on the second referendum, because that sort of helped them, it seems, if even just in the short term in the polls, but also it helps come the next election, because the idea is because the Supreme Court ruled against them, that they will turn the next election into a vote on whether or not to have another independence referendum, which, as you say, is de facto what it is each time anyway in people's eyes.
I have to say, I think it's a mad plan. I think it's completely mad. I think it puts at risk so much of what the SNP have achieved over the last sort of 20, even 30 years. They've been a gradualist party for a long time now, which is that they claim the sort of ground towards independence yard by yard rather than free by 93, as their old slogan had it, and things like that, where they make a crazed dash with claymores and kilts towards the border. That hasn't been the case for a long time. But attempting to use a general election as a definitive decision on Scotland's future goes against everything that they've done in these last few decades. And also, it's a huge risk on their own part, because they need to get 51% or whatever of voters supporting independence backing parties for that to be the case. But then, of course, even if they get that, they then require the British government to accept that that is a reasonable position for them to then begin negotiations for independence. And I suspect come that election, given the SNP haven't had anything like 51% for a long time. I think they got 45% last time, and they got in 30s the time before that. I suspect it will put as many voters off as it would attract voters to know that in a general election, there are any number of things you might want to vote for, but if you vote SNP, your vote will be taken as a mandate to begin independence negotiations. Now, if you're in favour of independence, that's fine, but there are people who vote SNP because they think they have been the best party to run Scotland, or to go down to Westminster and challenge the Westminster government, who I suspect will be put off by the radical nature of what their vote will be counted as being part of. Again, speaking to pollsters, I think the idea is that it's going to be an awful reach for the SNP to get above 50% in the next general election. Anything can happen, but it just seems such a gamble after everything they've achieved so far. And I don't know whether it's Nicola Sturgeon coming to the end of her time as First Minister, which she is, and just fancying another crazy dash at the finish line, not really thinking about what the carnage she might leave behind her in the pro-independence movement at that point, or whether she knows something that we don't. I suppose the sad thing for people like me is that if that becomes the target for the next general election, the idea that you can have a proper debate about education or health or the public services or the economy or whatever is just for the birds, because it will all be about grievance and all be about suggesting that Westminster is holding Scotland back, shouting at Westminster, calling Labour equal to the Tories. Down south, there'll be an election based on should the Tories stay in government or should Labour get them out. Up here, it will be should it be a bit independence or shouldn't it? And everything else gets squashed and not properly debated, and our public services continue to founder.
Yes, absolutely. I can really imagine that quite depressing situation. And obviously, it is a risk, but it does give them the opportunity not to have to be held accountable on their record those areas in that election campaign. However, the Labour Party in Scotland and indeed in England have long been trying to run elections on the state of our public services. And the public doesn't often take kindly to being told what an election should be run on. So it could be the other way around this time, and the public don't like that idea from the SNP, you're voting on independence, and actually do vote along the lines of how they feel public services should be run.
That would be a nice thing.
We'll see. We won't make any predictions now. And actually, talking about that relationship between Westminster and the Scottish Parliament, I did want to ask you about this. It's a different subject. But they passed the gender recognition bill at the end of last year, which means Scots from the age of 16 will be able to legally change their gender through a self-identification process for the first time. And in response, Alistair Jack, the Scotland Secretary here, has said that the UK government will consider using powers under the Scotland Act to prevent the bill becoming law. So there's this period where any bill agreed by MSPs comes under review by the UK government before reaching that royal assent stage and becoming an act. Is it likely that the UK government will actually go through with this? And wouldn't it create constitutional mayhem for them to try and veto a bill like this? Obviously, its health policy is devolved.
It is, but I guess I think it's Section 35 order. We've got used to the Section 30 order, which allows a referendum. We now have to get used to a Section 35 order, which allows, I think, the Secretary of State to intervene in devolved legislation. That exists for the reason that if the Scottish Parliament were to pass legislation that then had a consequence for the rest of the UK, the UK government didn't want. The UK government can intervene and say, you can't do that. Now, I'm sure there's a part of Nicola Sturgeon that is desperate for the UK government to intervene. It would no doubt, if they did, it would no doubt end up in the Supreme Court again. So yeah, you'd have a sort of referendum ruling redux, if you like, but this time on the Gender Recognition Act. And I think, as we saw, the fact that the Supreme Court ruled in favour of Westminster previously had something of a boost to the SNP's and independence as a voter preference. They might see this as being something that would really infuriate Scots, because although I suppose the other side of that is that the Gender Recognition Act is not popular in Scotland, according to all of the polls that we've seen. Each of the clauses that were in the, or each of the main measures that were in the Act, when tested in the polls, were, there was a substantial majority against them. It then comes down to whether people are comfortable with Westminster intervening because they don't like the Act itself, or whether they think that regardless of whether they're in favour of the Act as an individual, Westminster should be able to tell Holyrood what it can and can't do. I think it will be messy, whatever happens, and I'm sure Alistair Jack's weighing that up. It does come to the point that Holyrood is a statutory creation of Westminster. It's there to take decisions on health and education and the economy, and to give Scotland a greater democratic immediacy when it's discussing these things and deciding these things, rather than just wait for Westminster to get around to an hour a week or whatever it used to be. And that's what it's there for. But equally, Westminster is entitled to defend itself and the integrity of the United Kingdom and the impact that any of the devolved institutions might have on the rest of the UK if they feel they need to. I suppose what's important is that if Westminster is going to intervene, that it explains very clearly and fairly why it would be doing what it's doing. It would undoubtedly create chaos up here. It would infuriate yes voters, but everything infuriates yes voters and everything creates chaos up here. So maybe in the end, what you should do is do the right thing for your own institution and deal with the consequences after. But I'd be very surprised if Westminster didn't take some action and we end up at the Supreme Court again.
Right. Joy. Okay. We'll see. And they've not got long, so we'll see that in the coming weeks. I think that's all for now. Thanks so much, Chris. Thanks for coming back on. It was really good to have you back. And we will speak to you again soon.
Okay. All the best.
Hi, it's Anoush here. This is just a reminder that as a podcast listener, you have the option of subscribing to The New Statesman with a very special offer. You can subscribe for just £1 a week. That's 12 weeks for £12 if you go to newstatesman.com/podcast offer. We'll be right back.
If you enjoy the New Statesman podcast, then you'll love our daily politics newsletter, Morning Call. It's a quick, essential guide to the big political story each morning by me, Freddie Hayward and Rachel Wearmouth, featuring original reporting from Westminster and beyond, our analysis of the latest political news, and some recommendations of the best reads of the day. Sign up for free at the link in the podcast description.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
And now I'm delighted to be joined by Matt Hexter, co-host of the excellent Hiraeth Welsh Politics podcast. Matt, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Anoush.
In Wales, the big political story at the moment, as is the case across the UK, is the state of the health service. And we're recording on a Thursday. This episode will be out the following Monday. But at the time of recording, there's been two troubling stories, even in just the space of a day, from Wales concerning the health service. A man in Monmouthshire, I'm sure you've seen this, had to carry his granddad while he was suffering from a cardiac arrest into hospital because there was no ambulance for him. We're seeing similar stories in England as well at the moment. And the Welsh government advising NHS staff to discharge people home even without a care package. You can see how worrying that situation is. Care packages include people helping people dress, use the toilet, etc. And it seems that a move like that would only result in people having to return to hospital at a point soon. So Matt, do you want to start off by just giving us an overview of the state of the NHS in Wales? Are those two sort of anecdotes representative?
I think it's very clear that there are concerns about the NHS in Wales, but there are concerns about the NHS across the country. The stories that you have just talked about, Anusha, are indicative of wider concerns across the NHS in Wales. Social care, as you said, is a huge issue, whether that be now that people are being discharged out of hospital without a social care plan, or more importantly, perhaps, the fact that the absence of a functioning social care system across the UK means that more people are staying in hospital who could be discharged from those beds if social care plans are available. I think we've also seen in the last few weeks that many health boards across Wales are saying to people they shouldn't go to their A&E unless there is a life-threatening condition. And I think, of course, that is very worrying, but I think it has to be couched in the sort of devolved context to explain why the situation is potentially so bad in Wales. And I think, obviously, whilst the Senedd does have responsibility for the NHS and paying conditions, the full range of economic levers that are available in Westminster or even in Holyrood are not available to Cardiff Bay, which means that they're not in the economic position with which they would be able to improve the situation beyond what it currently is. The Welsh NHS budget is already half of the Welsh government's budget. So it's very difficult to see where additional funding can come from for this unless money, more money is spent in Westminster that can increase the Welsh government's budget through Barney consequentials.
That's really interesting. Let's talk a bit more about that, because Rishi Sunak has brought up the Welsh government's predicament with the NHS in PMQs, I'm sure you've seen. Clearly, he thinks this is a sort of weak point for Keir Starmer to get him on. In Labour-run Wales, the situation is like this. Why isn't Labour doing more to help patients in Wales? That kind of attack line. Health is a devolved policy matter, and there is a degree of responsibility from the Welsh government there. But what you're saying is their hands are actually tied. Where does the balance lie? How much can Mark Drakeford use that line of argument before he simply starts looking weak?
In Westminster, the Welsh NHS has long been used as a weapon against Labour. And David Cameron calling off his dyke, the line between life and death, to various Conservative PMs focusing on the fact that the Welsh government are the only government in the history of the UK to decrease NHS funding. However, as with many exchanges in Westminster, the content of debate and the question sessions are focused usually on quick barbs and winning duels rather than providing any sort of helpful context to the debate. So it's always important to remember the very limited economic levers available to the Welsh government, and because it does remain in the main Westminster, which holds Wales's purse strings. So in terms of tax, because it's a very easy one to understand.
Yeah.
In Wales, we can vary our tax rates. So we could add, say, an extra penny onto the pound in income tax, but we don't have any control over the tax thresholds. We've seen in Scotland where they've altered the bands to say that this particular group of earners should pay more. In Wales, we don't have that power. We'd have to operate within the existing bands as provided to us by the UK government. So again, in the context of those tax bands, if you put an extra one penny on the pound on the base rate of tax in Wales, you'd raise an additional 220, 230 million. If you put an extra penny on the higher rate, you'd raise around £30 million. And then on the additional rate, between £3 and £5 million addition, because Wales doesn't have a very big top high additional rate of taxpayers. So whilst that sounds like a lot to me or you in governmental terms, it's not that much. And also in the context of pay rises, which is one of the massive things that has caused so much pressure on the NHS, the fact that we're seeing increased industrial action, for every 1% of additional pay you give to a public sector worker in Wales, that will cost you £100 million. And I think it doesn't take a genius to work out that what people in the public sector are calling for and that additional money, it doesn't go very far. And that is also when you consider you'd have to spend some of that additional money on frontline services.
Right. Okay. Because of course, and you mentioned it there, there have been strikes among NHS workers in Wales as well as in England. This means that basically, Mark Drakeford and the Welsh government is not able to give those workers what they want. Is there an appreciation that there are limits on what they can do within the sort of devolved structure of the UK? Or is there as much anger and disappointment in the Labour-run government there as there appears to be in England among health workers and indeed the public regarding the nurses' strikes and the refusal to negotiate?
I mean, there are concerns about public services here, as there are in other parts of the UK. However, unfortunately, Wales doesn't really have the same level of political news coverage as England, and nor does it have the same sort of level of Devo literacy amongst the general population as you may see in Scotland. That increased during the pandemic, knowledge of what, which government was responsible for what increased, and the nuances of how things are funded and who is responsible for things such as paying conditions isn't necessarily widely understood. And additionally, in Wales, there is a tendency for people to attribute good things to the Welsh government, even when it happens in a non-devolved area. And similarly, there's a tendency for bad things to attribute to the UK government, even when it does occur in a devolved area. So you can argue there's an accountability deficit, which isn't good for Welsh democracy, but politically that doesn't seem to be having much of an impact on the Welsh government. As seen in recent Senedd polls, it shows that Welsh Labour have their largest lead for over a decade.
Right, interesting. You've just been explaining very eloquently and very clearly the way that it's structured. But these kind of discussions about Barnett consequentials, etc., they're difficult for Labour politicians to make in a soundbite. And you were talking about that kind of the barbs and the duelling in Westminster. It's difficult for politicians, even in Parliament, in Westminster, to make those kind of arguments when they're being attacked along those lines. You used to work as a staffer for some Welsh Labour politicians. Yeah. I hope you don't mind me mentioning that. How do Labour politicians make those kind of arguments in a way that the public can quickly understand without getting too much into the weeds of trying to explain devolution and how it works?
I think that the concept of austerity is now well understood. And for a long time in Wales, the understanding has been that we are underfunded by the UK government. And I think that has seeped through to most people. Most people do understand that the public realm has been underfunded by the UK government. If that's your particular political opinion anyway, you may think that what the UK government is doing is responsible, etc. But I think that most people do understand that although the Welsh government is responsible for funding the Welsh NHS, that the Welsh government's funding is still controlled by the UK government. And I think most people don't understand necessarily how the tax raising system works in the devolved context. So they're not necessarily calling on the Welsh government to increase taxes. And I think that at the moment, with the cost of living crisis, they're unlikely to make that call.
Right. Okay. But it's, of course, an argument that the SNP can use because they are going to raise taxes in Scotland on higher earners to boost spending on health and social care. And it's an argument they can use against Labour. Why aren't you doing this in Wales? You've explained very clearly why it's a different situation. But does it not eventually make Mark Drakeford look weak, not using the levers that are available to him?
It's very difficult, Anoush, because I think that Mark Drakeford has, for a long time, been seen to be reticent to use those tax-raising powers. He recently revealed in an interview that if Liz Truss's plan to drop a penny off the rate, so go down to, and get rid of the additional rate of tax, he probably would have used Welsh powers to raise that back up to where it was. But he's long been reticent to use these powers. And I think because of how poorly they are constructed compared to the Scottish powers, it is very difficult to use them. They're a bit of a blunt instrument. And because of how close we are to England, it would become a really big political issue. What happens if you work in Bristol and live in Wales and vice versa? Where do you pay your tax? How do you move that money across the border? Also, whilst the tax rates are being constructed in the way they are, they're a huge political weapon. So the Conservatives will use that, both sides of the border. In Wales, tax is never, even though we've had these powers for a little time now, it's never really been an election issue. The Welsh Conservatives haven't really talked about dropping the Welsh rate of tax. And I think that if, as soon as that power is used, it becomes a live political issue here, one that will be used by Welsh Conservatives against the Welsh government, but also by the UK government against the Labour Party in Westminster.
Yeah. No, I can really see that situation. But despite this dilemma, you mentioned earlier in the interview that Welsh Labour are high up in the polls. Is this a failure of the opposition parties in Wales, or is it a sign of Welsh Labour's strength?
A little column A, a little column B. I don't know to what extent your listeners know, but obviously Plaid Cymru entered into a cooperation agreement with the Welsh government, and that has nullified the potency of their opposition. Obviously, I think we've been talking about health. Health is not covered within the scope of that agreement necessarily between Labour and Plaid Cymru. Social care is to a different degree. But I think the general economic landscape has made them less willing to attack Welsh Labour in health and has made them less willing to call on funds be reallocated from other departments towards DNF because they have their agreed areas where they've made deals with the Welsh government and they want to see that money spent there. And I think the Conservatives have been focusing on the NHS in Wales for a very long time, but it's very hard to get cut through for the Welsh Conservatives whilst the UK government in Westminster is perceived to be poorly. So the opposition hasn't been as strong as it could be, but I think that Welsh Labour do have a winning formula in Wales. I think we've recently seen Welsh Labour celebrate 100 years of electoral dominance in Wales, 100 years of being the largest party. They are the most dominant party in the democratic world. And if I had to put money on it, I'd say that they'd probably get to another 100 years of dominance in Wales too. And I don't think that's necessarily being arrogant. I think the Welsh Labour Party have been able to adapt to change and make themselves reflective of Wales. They are, behind my head, the phrase clear red water. They've been able to ensure that it's perfectly possible to be proudly Welsh and proudly Labour at the same time. They haven't, as Labour did in Scotland and arguably also in England, sacrificed the flag. Clear red water has come to mean so much more than what it did at the time, this rejection of UK Labour's choice-based agenda. Now it means you can be in Wales, you could vote Labour not only because they're left-wing, but because they're also quintessentially Welsh. And I think that Welsh Labour's ability to encapsulate that mood of the nation means that they are in an incredibly strong position and will continue to be for the foreseeable future.
Mm. And when you put it like that, it does really make you think about Keir Starmer's Labour and Labour in Scotland, perhaps to a slightly lesser extent. But have they learnt those lessons from Welsh Labour's identity and brand even? I know it's a glib way of putting it, but you do feel as if they've got this kind of quite an impressive formula in Wales that they haven't quite managed to grasp in England. Obviously, Labour are doing much better in the polls across the country. But there is still this slight tension in the Labour Party in England about being a patriotic party, but as well as being a progressive party that I don't think they've quite managed to nail yet, even though that is one of their priorities.
Yeah, I think it's very hard. I think that the British left has been less willing for a long time to embrace this idea of progressive patriotism. I think someone said that many years ago. Than we have in Wales. I think in Wales, we are much more comfortable with the idea of socialism and not nationalism, but certainly being proud of the country you seek to run are ideas that fit much more neatly together in the eyes of a Welsh left-wing person than necessarily they have done in the eyes of the British left for a long time. And I think that Keir Starmer has done a lot of good work in terms of making Labour more closely attributed to the Union flag. I think that there possibly needs to be more work to boil down into what exactly that means and how the Labour Party can find the right balance that the Welsh Labour Party have done, making people feel proud to be British in the same way that people in Wales feel proud to be Welsh, but also proud to back a progressive party. So I think there's more work to be done in the UK sense of exactly how that works in practice. And I think also, Anoush, one of the things that we in Wales for a long time have discussed in terms of the UK Labour Party is, and John Denham has done lots of work on this, is the idea of an English Labour Party. And I think that the UK Labour Party could do a lot of good work in the space of trying to make themselves feel. At the same time, they can be a Labour Party for the whole UK, but specifically at the moment, given the purview of what they're responsible for, and respecting their sister parties in Scotland and Wales, that they also can be a good English Labour Party at the same time.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And just lastly, looking ahead towards a potential next general election, you know, you mentioned that you think that Welsh Labour's sort of electoral success will continue riding high in Senate elections. How about in the next general election? Obviously, the Conservatives made inroads in what we very simplistically call the Red Wall in 2019. Will the Red Wall of Wales be rejecting the Tories next time round, do you think? I know it's unfair to ask for predictions, but what's your sense of how politics is shifting in those kind of areas?
On Hereith, we have a big klaxon noise that goes off every time anyone makes a prediction. It's a really good way.
Well, you're klaxon free here. This is safe space.
It's difficult, I think, because obviously we'll have very different boundaries in Wales. For those of you who are listening who don't know, Wales will go down from 40 Westminster seats to 30. Oh. But on the current polling, it does look like Labour will do very well in Wales. I can see a significant number of those North Wales seats that were lost to the Conservatives going back to Labour. Obviously, there's also Ynys Môn in Anglesey up in North Wales, which was won by the Conservatives last time. This time you've got Plaid Cymru, who'll be standing in that seat, who's the current MS for that constituency, very popular. So whilst you would usually expect that in a big Labour swing, that seat may go back to Labour. It could go Plaid this time. Lots of unique little local battles like that. But I mean, on current polling, there's only one seat in Wales that Labour has never held. That's Montgomeryshire. And even on current polling, some polls have Labour winning Montgomeryshire, but I don't see that happening necessarily. But with the current swings you're seeing, yeah, I would definitely imagine that whilst I wouldn't expect sort of 97-level Conservative-free Wales, I'd certainly see fewer Conservatives in Wales, well, being represented in Westminster in Welsh constituencies than we have at the moment.
Interesting. Okay, we'll keep an eye on that. Thanks so much, Matt. It was great having you on, and hopefully we'll speak to you again at some point.
Well, thank you very much, Nuj.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Anoush Shakelian, my colleague Chris Deering, and our guest, Matt Hexter. Thanks so much for listening. Don't forget to leave us a nice review and subscribe. We're produced by Adrian Bradley, and our music is Devil with the Devil, licensed under Creative Commons.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.